Boccaccio's debut.
That's what.
Whew. Are you nervous?
Oh, I'm very nervous.
There you go. We've just clipped the intro. There. Thanks, Joseph.
Do not do this one again, Joseph. Don't do it. Don't do it.
He did it.
Before we get into today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in this episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. All right, let's jump into the episode. All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of ZeroX Research. The BlockWorks research team is back to bring you another analyst roundtable. Today is Monday, April 15th. I'm joined by long time no see Dan and Boccaccio from the BlockWorks research team to jam on the latest market happenings. Before we dive into it, I do have some exciting news for you all. Boccaccio is going to be the new co-host of ZeroX Research, so expect to hear a lot more from him going forward.
Let's go.
Hype. Super hype. Anyways, diving straight into it for some news and governance updates. I think it's been quite a busy week, to be honest. Starting us off, we have the Hong Kong ETFs that were just announced. Spot Bitcoin and Ethereum ETFs are going to be tradable very, very soon. I think, obviously, the US ETFs was like a sort of a larger unlock for the crypto markets, but just having Asia have like easy access to these ETFs is just good. I don't know how much money there is in China that's going to bid the BTC and ETH ETFs through like Hong Kong, but that's still like a nice narrative to have, you know. Like, I think people forget that Asia has a lot of money at the end of the day to bid crypto. Some other thing on the news and governance update, Parcel Token will become tradable at tomorrow 1 p.m. UTC, or when you're listening to this, it's going to be Wednesday. So actually, it's going to become tradable yesterday on April 16th, 1 p.m. UTC. So for those that are unfamiliar, Parcel is sort of like a real estate perp trading protocol, but more than that, they also have a real estate oracle. They've sort of pioneered this data collection slash evaluation method for like real estate prices and bring those on chain. And they're not just used for Parcel's own perp trading product. They're also used relatively frequently and quoted in sort of like more TradFi articles when it comes to real estate pricing. So that's pretty exciting to hear. I'll take a pause there. And any thoughts on like the Hong Kong ETFs or Parcel's token?
I can chat a bit about Parcel. I read a bunch about the other real estate, real world asset protocol. Parcel isn't one, but it's like the alternative. And the other, I think one of them is called Realty. And these are like so complicated and just like very difficult to work with. I think one of them is on Gnosis, and it like you can only swap it on a sushi swap fork DEX. So I'm not sure how useful like that you can short or long real estate is like realistically, but I do think it's like the best product out there. If somebody was interested in doing that would like they would do it through Parcel.
Yeah, it's interesting that I don't know. That seems kind of like a goofy thing, like in general, but I don't. It's an interesting soiree into what real estate and blockchain, what the overlap between the two will look like. I'm not sure if we've really cracked the nut on that. Because I don't know how valuable it is to like long Miami, short the Midwest, but we'll see. What's did you mention the pre-market futures valuation, Ren?
I didn't, but if I'm not wrong, on Ava it's trading around 1.6 billion.
I mean, we're seeing some pretty hot valuations these days, so I guess that's
yeah.
Fair on a relative basis at the minimum. I mean, that's really what matters. Like looking at the nominal number doesn't get you very far, but on a relative basis, I think that's what most people in this industry are looking at, and that's probably the best thing to do. I don't know if there's really any good comps for Parcel that are trading today. I don't think so.
I'm not hyped about anything like real estate related on chain until I can pay for my mortgage with like Eigenlayer ABS yield. I think that's the ultimate end game, to be honest. But I mean, Parcel, I think it won't be like a crazy airdrop just considering they're airdropping 7.5% of the supply at a 1.6 billion FTB to like $240,000 for like some ridiculous numbers. If you just like do the math, that's like $500 on average. So, but still, like, it's an interesting protocol. I think they've like done growth like pretty correctly. They did like season one, and then they had like a sped up season two, and like an even more sped up like season three. And they have this sort of like perpetual points program. So, all right, a few other things on the news and governance side of things. Aptos sort of announced that they are working with IONET. I'm not sure specifically what they are actually doing on Aptos, but if I had to guess, this was sort of like a move that they had to do just because of Solana congestion. There's a lot of protocols where the core functionality just doesn't work, and because it takes like way too many tries to get your transactions through. So it'll be interesting to see like what on-chain components they're actually sort of like doing on Aptos now, and whether you can split that workload between two different chains. Because I mean, if your core like info is on one chain, you would need some form of like bridge to bridge like the messages from like Aptos back to Solana to register that some event has taken place. So yeah, would love to hear like any thoughts on like whether that was the correct business move. But another thing on the news side is BlackRock has allowed BlackRock's USD Institutional Digital Liquidity Fund, also known as BILD, holders to exchange their shares for USDC with Circle. I've always felt like if there was a stablecoin that was going to become a CBDC, it would probably be USDC. And I think like we're just like slowly but surely like inching towards that future with like everything BlackRock's doing with USDC and Circle, especially because BlackRock is often known as like sort of the fourth arm of the government.
Yeah, on the first piece, the Aptos and IONET overlap there. That's really interesting to see. We had Greg Asuri from Akash Network, who's also building a GPU marketplace, on the podcast a couple months ago, and he had an interesting takeaway saying something to the, and I'm paraphrasing here, but something to the effect of, you know, there's trade-offs to be had with building your own app chain because they are built in the Cosmos on the Cosmos SDK, and you have to incentivize a validator set to secure your chain. And that can be costly in the form of inflation to the protocol. And so he was saying, you know, back when we made that decision to build on the Cosmos SDK, Solana just wasn't capable for us. And this conversation occurred in the pre-congestion era for Solana. You know, Solana, the UX on Solana is quite poor right now because of transaction overload effectively. And he was basically making the point that, you know, if there was an L1 that could handle the throughput reliably that we need, you know, that could be a better choice for us. And I bet you he's feeling quite vindicated that he's not on Solana right now. And they did invest the time and effort into building their own app chain to kind of have their own state that they can, you know, not have to this noisy neighbor problem where other activity on the chain is now impacting you. I can't speak directly to the IONET and Aptos overlap. But yeah, I have to imagine, Ren, to your point, you know, it's hard to land a transaction on right now on Solana, and that's becoming a problem. They're rolling out some fixes we can talk about later, but that's the current state today. And so if you're a business building on top of that chain, you need to continue operating your business at the most maximal level, getting onto some of these Gen 3 chains that are optimized for performance, similar to how Solana was, but using newer research and technology to power your chain, and that don't have a lot of usage today. You know, Sui and Aptos are kind of the two market leaders in this like Gen 3 chain, if you will, era where they're kind of came after the chains that came after Solana in terms of when they hit the market, mostly in the 2023 timeframe. And they have great tech and not a lot of adoption. So honestly, I'm very fascinated to kind of see the two of them make their plays at what segment for the market that what market segments they're going to go after. I think DeepIn makes a ton of sense, right? That's DeepIn really only exists on Solana today because it did have that initial higher throughput capability that other chains did not. And now that that's kind of coming under crunch, I think Solana on an average day does anywhere between like 500 and 1,000 sustained TPS, which is the most of any chain today. And so once we see some of these larger DeepIn projects that kind of get the ball rolling in terms of their usage and their adoption, move on to some of these newer chains, I'm really, really intrigued to see how they handle this new wave of adoption, because the problems for Solana are there's like it's kind of twofold at the networking layer and the economic side of things at the fee mechanism side. We didn't really know this was going to happen until we hit this scale, right? Again, it's the most used in terms of transaction count chain today. And so, yeah, I'm just super fascinated to kind of have this mentality of what's the fastest thing we got today. Let's push it to the limits until it breaks, fix it, and then just like keep rallying around whatever ends up being the best thing, and like sort of some like natural selection evolution playing through here in terms of what tech stacks we continue to build. I think you're seeing some really good development on of course Solana, but also on the OP stack with what Base is doing. And then again, if we can get some adoption to Sui and Aptos, I'm super intrigued to see how those chains handle and like a wave of higher throughput.
Do you think, I'm not sure how it works, but do you think this makes the case for like Solana L2s? Then I have no clue how an L2 on like Solana works when it comes to like data posting sequencer and like whether like transactions, like data posting transactions would still need to go through like the whole networking layer congestion. But I mean, you've already seen a few protocols launches like or announce L2s on Solana, notably like Grass. I think they're doing an L2 and there was one more that I'm banking on. But yeah, do you think Solana L2 season is coming?
I mean, it's definitely an interesting question. I mean, functionally, it would look a lot just like Ethereum, right? Like you're posting batches of transactions down to the L1. You could do something maybe potentially more interesting with Base sequencing because the L1 has shorter block times. And so like the hassle of going in between two L2s using the L1, maybe isn't the burden isn't that high. You could also do other things where you can look at the shortcomings of Ethereum L2s, which is hands down the fragmentation of liquidity, like yes and no. Like there's liquidity is fragmented across these different L2s, but quite honestly, they all have so much liquidity at this point, it's not a huge issue. It's really just that the apps themselves are fragmented across these L2s, right? So if me as a user, I don't want to have to pick which L2 I go play on. I want to like use the app on that L2. And when, you know, there's three apps that I want to use across three different L2s, that's three extra bridging transactions I have to deal with. And so you could kind of try to make the play where you as the base layer make a little bit more opinionated of a decision. So you're not as credibly neutral and that's very much a stance Ethereum has taken. And you look at like something like the Polygon aggregator or the aggregation layer, the ag layer, as they like to call it. You say like, hey, this is the Solana Foundation is going to build this thing. We're all going to use it. You can go build your own thing. That's fine. But like, this is going to kind of going to be the one we kind of coalesce around. And then try to build out that way. I think that'd be a great way to kind of learn from some of the shortcomings of Ethereum. I think it's gonna be really hard for Polygon to kind of bootstrap their network around their specific ag layer. I think they're doing the right things. I just think the incentives are for everyone to have their own ag layer right now, right? ZK Sync's gonna want their own one. Scroll's gonna want their own one. Polygon's gonna want their own one, of course. And ZK Tech is really hard and really expensive. I think Polygon said they've invested over $1 billion over their lifetime into ZK Tech. We had the Polygon team on the Lightspeed podcast, and I believe that's what Mark, the CEO, said. And if it's not quite $1 billion, it's probably a ballpark that number. And so that's why the incentives are for everyone to be right, right? If you invested $1 billion and then everyone just ends up using someone else's solution, you know, at least you push the space forward. But like, you know, that's kind of the pull there. So I guess that was kind of a really roundabout answer to say, I don't know. I don't think you're going to see general purpose L2s on top of Solana, but you might see some app specific stuff. I mean, Vibhu, the founder of Drip, has been kind of vocal about the shortcomings of the base layer for his product. You know, they're building an app, they're building a business on top of Solana, and this congestion is negatively impacting their business, and the fees were negatively impacting their business. And like, it's a fair point of like, do I need my own dedicated block space? So I think like app specific space makes sense. The way that we need to figure out is like, how do we do that in a way that has the least amount of friction, right? You need to do this in a, like the most seamless way possible. I don't know. And there's like a lot of chatter starting to churn up around a lot of AVSs on EigenLayer are building using the Cosmos SDK, which is of course natively interoperable with IBC. And so that gets pretty interesting. You basically have like something that looks sort of like an L2, right? Like an AVS. And they're all kind of, they have this pretty reliable, pretty solid communication channel in IBC. If you wanted to know like what the UX of IBC looks like, I would recommend ibc.fun. Skip Team's building that. Super fun way to, not really fun, but super easy way to interact with IBC and move from chain to chain. With the launch of Circle's CCTP, They've also integrated Solana directly into their UI, so you can move from Solana to any USDC on Solana to basically any Cosmos chain. It's actually quite cool. But yeah, long-winded answer to say, I don't think we're going to see general purpose L2s, but that said, I do think we will see maybe some app-specific stuff. I don't know. TBD. You'll see general purpose SVM L2s, though. I mean, we already know we're going to see Eclipse. I'd be surprised if Eclipse was the only L2 that says, hey, we're going to, you know, build on Celestia DA and maybe settle down to Solana instead of settling down to Ethereum. So I don't know. You'll see some exciting use cases with the SVM, but I don't know about directly a general purpose Solana L2. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, I appreciate the insight there. And yeah, I fully agree. I don't think we're going to see general purpose Solana L2s. If there will be, definitely be like app specific. But I will shoot it over to Boccaccio now, who also has some news updates for us.
Yes. So Monad raised 225 mil, led by Paradigm, to bring 10,000 TPS to the EVM. I think it's reportedly at a $3 billion valuation, but I'm not sure. Previously, they raised 19 mil back in February 2023. I don't really have like a take on this one. I just think we talked about this last time I was on OX Research about like how valuations are kind of creeping up. And I think this is like, if it is free bill, which I think it might even be a little bit higher, I think it's like a good showcase of like how valuations are starting to creep up a bit. And like VC saying, we don't really find the returns that we want in the private markets anymore. Like, I think that makes sense. Apart from that, Sui launched their handheld gaming console, Sui OX1, which will allow for users to play both crypto and non-crypto games. This is like the third attempt at hardware by L1s. The Saga phone did well. And then Aptos did Jambo phone. I don't know if you guys looked into that one. I'm not sure how good a handheld gaming console will do for crypto gaming, especially since crypto gaming is not doing particularly well. So like investing in hardware seems like a bit much, but I guess it's a bit better than like incentive programs, because in this way you're actually just developing hardware. And one last thing, I feel like they should have just gone into mobile gaming instead of, I can see Dan kind of getting ready to hop in this one, but I feel like they should have gone into mobile gaming instead of like developing this, like, but I don't know. What do you
think? I mean, it's an interesting question, right? Like, if you're going to make a device, what device do you make? So you mentioned the Saga phone from Solana, and that's really interesting. It like didn't do well out of the gates, and then the Bonk price ran up, and people realized all the phones had an airdrop of Bonk that became worth more than the phone at one point. Then they sold out, and then they made the 2.0. And I will say, I feel a little bit vindicated here, because my prediction, I think I made it on this podcast as well, was it's sort of like a Tesla when you're making this like new blockchain enabled phone. You don't want to own the first Tesla, right? Those were the ones that like randomly combusted and the pedals would fall off on the new Cybertrucks. I don't know if you guys saw that clip where the gas pedal, the accelerator pedal, like broke off and slid and got wedged in the fully down position. Fortunately, the driver was okay. But like, you know, there's just like shit that breaks on the Gen 1 of things. And that's kind of how I thought the Saga phone would play out, and sort of how it did, right? Like, I got the privilege to play with one, and it's quite cool. But like, there's like a real app store and then like a DeFi crypto app store, and it's just empty. Basically, there's a couple apps, but you can see how it'll get somewhere really cool, but it's just not there yet. But you basically have two options, right? Like, what device do I build? Do I want to go the mobile phone? And if I win the mobile phone wars, I will have the device that everybody uses to access the internet in, you know, my device is in everybody's hands. That's very, very powerful. It's so powerful that Google and Apple have like armies building the best phone possible. So it's like very hard to displace. You know, it'd be a huge burden for me to like take anything that like swapped out my iPhone. I'm probably not going to do it. Even if it's better, the iPhone is so ingrained in my life. All my friends have iPhones. I don't want to be the guy with green messages. This is not going to happen. But you know, my gaming, I like gaming, so I would consider buying this device. And I haven't touched my Nintendo Switch in probably a full year. So there you go. They have a very low bar to hit for this to be a better game, to be like my go-to device for gaming. So, but you know, if you win this war of being the go-to gaming device, you have a much narrower scope. So it's kind of just like a different trade-off is how I think about building a phone versus some other form of hardware is your chance of winning. So, and the size of the market, right? It's sort of like a venture play, right? What's the TAM and what percent of that do I need to be successful? Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. And it looks cool, looks slick, looks like a PSP. I'm definitely excited to get my hands on one.
I will caveat here that I've been a PC gamer for like most of my life, but you know, like that, I used to have a PSP 2000 and like those were definitely good times, but I haven't bought like any of these like new sort of like handheld gaming consoles after like the PSP. I don't know. I think when it comes to crypto gaming, I would definitely say mobile gaming is probably the sector to target. Like the mobile gaming is just like insanely huge in Asia. Like however big you think like mobile gaming degeneracy and addiction is, like just 10x that, like honestly. Like the amount that like Asian and especially like Chinese spend on their phone and just play like these like games is just crazy. I'm not sure if like knowing that fact and knowing that like mobile gaming is huge in like China and like especially like emerging markets in the Asia region, I don't think trying to like create your own hardware phone is the right move, given that like this purchasing class already has like established brands. They're sort of like middle tier like phones that like provide like insane bang for your buck. And these sort of like middle tier brands also have like high tier phones that are able to compete with like say like Apple and like Google Pixel. So I think at this stage, like just trying to create like quote unquote like crypto native hardware doesn't make a lot of sense to me, to be honest, especially for gaming. I'm not sure like how hard it is to like port over like gaming libraries or whatever, but if I'm living in like an emerging market, right, like I'm not spending like $300 or whatever to buy like a handheld gaming console to play like whatever like crypto game. And if I'm living in like a developed market, I'm just gonna buy like a Steam Deck or whatever it's called, or like a Nintendo Switch. I'm not gonna like buy this new like handheld gaming console. So I think the right move actually is to build games that interoperate with like existing gaming systems, since these are such like large and existing ecosystems already. I'm not sure if hardware is the right move. I can like kind of see like the point of like Solana Saga, since like he's trying to like disrupt like the app store, or Anatoly's trying to disrupt the app store duopoly. But gaming, I'm not sure, to be honest. I feel a lot less comfortable with gaming, a gaming hardware push.
Yeah, I definitely don't think this is for developed markets though. And honestly, I don't think like Sui is the blockchain for developed markets. There's only 100 validators. It's not really scalable. It's all-to-all communication between the nodes. Not scalable in the sense of like adding, you know, getting to 10,000 nodes. I don't think that's on the near-term roadmap or anything. And so their play just feels like to try to be a little different. And I mean, like on-chain gaming is such a strange thing, right? It's like we've been talking about it for 4 years now, and it's still not even anywhere near having any fun game to play. It feels, I mean, I can see Boccaccio being like, there's card games, brother. But I don't know. I like that they're doing this because it's a different route. And I, you know, to Mert always talks about this on Lightspeed. So now I feel like I'm just a broken record of saying things Mert says, and that's a very dangerous game to play. But you know, we got to try all the paths, and this is a new one, so I'm excited.
I just feel like it's kind of like somebody was like, oh, like we need to do something in gaming, what do we do? Oh, there's like my kid loves the Nintendo Switch, let's just build something like that, and then they partner with someone to get it out. I know it's like a new path, and I do think that it's like it's better than the Jambo phone, because I don't know what that is like. Do you know what I mean? I feel like that was a straight copy paste of the Saga phone. But
I'll chime in here. I actually think that Jamba phone is a lot more interesting to me than both the Solana Saga and the Sway like handheld gaming console for a few reasons. First of all, it's priced at $99, which is like insanely cheap. And they are like laser focused on, if I'm not wrong, sort of like the Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America region. And for a lot of these like phone users, the brand doesn't really matter. Like they just want like a cheap functional phone. And like $99 is as cheap as it gets. And I talked to one of the persons working at Aptos, working on the Jamba phone. And basically the strategy is like, there's going to be like 16 crypto apps like preloaded from day one. And then there's going to be like tasks. And like you do these tasks, there's going to be like daily rewards. And there's this like ridiculous like token like drop flywheel. And it's like Solana Saga is like for rich people. And then like Jamba is like the slightly less like developing economy version of that, where people are going to get probably like a stupid amount of money that will like offset the $99 cost of the phone in like, I don't know, like 2 weeks. So I think like fundamentally that phone is a lot more interesting to me than like a handheld gaming console, and maybe even Solana Saga, dare I say, to be honest.
Solana Saga isn't great though. That was just like Dan said, it's the bonk airdrop. At yeah. some point you were covering 2x, and then people were like, the same thing that they did with Tia, where they were like, oh, this is infinite airdrops. And then everybody bought, like, I know people who bought 2.5k sagas. So, and now I don't think they've had an airdrop in a while. So, I don't know.
I just looked up one stat real quick, Boccaccio. I was curious how many units of a Nintendo Switch have been sold, and this is off of 30 seconds of Googling, so take it with a grain of salt here. But apparently, according to Wikipedia, the world's most trusted source, 139 million units were sold as of December 2023. So let's say you get 10% of that. You get a blockchain-enabled gaming device in the hands of roughly 14 million people. I don't know. That's kind of cool. I'm intrigued.
Percent of the people who created Super Mario and everything, you're giving it that. They're like, oh yeah. The thing is, I feel like at this point, if you're Sui, like even Solana didn't have like a lot of apps until the start of the year. Not this year, but like let's say last year, like a lot of apps that you could use.
True.
And they started airdropping money and then like the incentive. And Sui also did this very well as well. They had last October, or maybe 2022 October, they had an incentive program, I think like $150 million. And so it got a lot of TVL and activity on chain. So I feel like that's what they should be focusing on, like for gaming as well. Not like an incentive program where you give apps money or like game developers money, but like directly to people. So that like that's how I feel like you should boost it as opposed to this. But I mean, it's... I think it's okay. Like, I don't think it'll be 10% of... I also don't think you think that, but I'm going to make it seem like you think that. I disagree with you, Daniel. I don't think they'll get 10% of Nintendo's sales.
Okay, that was aggressive. I'll give it to you. I'm glad you called me out. That's fair. That is far too aggressive. If they sold 14 million units, that would be the most successful blockchain-related product in history.
I don't think they could produce, like, 10% of that.
There's no way that they're making 14 million of these things. They'd have to like double down and order a new batch.
Yeah. Last piece of news is Binance listed BitTensor Tau for spot trading. This is relatively big because one of the big issues with Tau is that you can't custody it very well. So funds and institutions can't buy it because it doesn't work with ledgers. And it wasn't on any like trusted exchanges. It'll be exciting to see how it turns out. I don't know. I know Daniel doesn't really believe in Tao that much, but I think Tao is the narrative leader. So I think it'll be cool to see how this goes over the next few months.
I mean, I'm a little sus, but that's fair. I don't think that's a crazy position. Is it the narrative leader? 100% agree. I'm just very sus of like 99.9% of the AI plays, and I want AI agents specifically to be more real than anybody else. I can promise you of that. Yes. But anybody promising AI agents before ChatGPT gets right access over your computer is not true. That is not happening. They'll be first, and then everything will come after.
I don't know. Wayfinder posted a screenshot of AI agents, so it's very close. It's coming.
I know. I just think that's my mental barometer. I think that's this summer, so you know, a couple of months from now. So I do think we're close. And then I think AI once, like, why I think that's my barometer is right now. You ask, okay, so I recently bought a house, and the realtor asked what I did at one point, and right when I told her, it was like, I do not say crypto right out of the gates, to be clear. And you start with like tech company, then like research, and then kind of like whittle down. The second I said tech, she asked me about AI. So like normal ass people are like AI aware, but they think you like high schoolers use it to cheat on their homework, right? And they do, but it's obviously much more than that. Once you can start using it to like do tasks that you tell it to do, that's when shit gets real for the average person. And like, if you're really into the AI space or like software engineering or any of that, you probably heard of the Devin release. Devin's like this software engineer based AI that you can just say, hey, build me a website that does X, Y, and Z. And it just does it. Like it really is like an agent. Instead of like the current ChatGPT, which says, you know, here's the instructions to go do something. That's the difference, is doing it versus being told how to do it. And once the average person can be like, send an email to my boss that I have the flu and won't be in today, and you just press go, and then you like go back to bed and your boss gets notified from this AI agent, that's the shit that's gonna like start this next wave of AI discussion. So I'm definitely paying attention. I think Tao is a little bit sus, and I don't think that's a crazy stance to be in. But yeah.
It's not. It's a completely fair stance to be in. Yeah.
All right. I think that's a good spot to move on from our news and governance sections. But now moving on to our DYDX segment with a quick word from Wintermute. All right, guys. For this week's DYDX segment, we have Callan, head of governance from Wintermute. Thank you so much for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Ren. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So for starters, what role does Wintermute play within the DYDX ecosystem?
Sure. So Wintermute's been pretty involved in DYDX for quite a long time. Firstly, we're investors, but we integrated into their V1 product back in the day and have ramped up our liquidity provision ever since. We were one of the largest market makers on V3 and integrated into V4 shortly after its launch. We've also been very active in governance since inception, most notably proposing changes towards the LP rewards program, where we introduced maker volume and also shifted rewards to more active LPs. We also had the V4 Vanguard, which was a myriad of proposals targeting some areas we thought could have been improved before the launch of V4, most notably a 45% reduction in trading rewards. And then other than that, personally, I've been a part of the DYDX Operations SubDAO, and we also hold a seat on the DYDX Grant SubDAO.
That's great to hear. And I think it's a really unique opportunity for like a market maker on Wintermute to have such an active role within DYDX. I think that's something that you may not always be able to see. For example, when Wintermute market makes on like a centralized exchange, like you guys have zero say on like maker rebates or whatever. So that's super cool to see. The next question I wanted to ask was, what type of DeFi protocols does Wintermute interface with? And have there been any challenges / learnings throughout the years?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious, to be honest. Like, we mostly deal with DeFi applications that are like relevant to us on the trading side, right? So we interact a lot with AMM and limit order book DEXs, RFQs, aggregators, all that sort of stuff. In terms of learnings, I would say like, it's pretty much ongoing. You know, there's always our main challenge is really like counterparty risk and smart contract risk. And so we're always ensuring that we're minimizing this risk according to, you know, how much funds we have connected to, I guess, you know, these DeFi platforms. I'd say we also occasionally touch lending platforms, but other than that, that's, yeah, really the most of it.
Just a quick question. What do you guys do on lending platforms, just out of curiosity?
Sometimes, you know, there's like, we have looked into liquidations, but if we do need to borrow certain assets, that is definitely a avenue that we do look at.
Okay, super interesting. And sort of the last question I had was, how has Wintermute's involvement within various DeFi protocols evolved over the years? For example, I've noticed it feels like in 2023, you guys became a lot more active in governance, perhaps than before, and would love to hear sort of like how that has evolved.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I guess, you know, as AMMs and perps are some of the largest sectors of DeFi, we're constantly integrating with new protocols. So that's kind of like our horizontal expansion in that sense. But yeah, I mean, one of our main goals at Wintermute is like to really empower decentralization and push that world forward. So you know, at the beginning of 2023, we launched our delegate platforms. And that was like a super important initiative for us, which in some cases wasn't even strategic. It was literally that we want to empower decentralization. So yeah, we're a big delegate across like Uniswap, Optimism, Compound, DYDX, Aave, and Arbitrum. And yeah, it's been really great. You know, we've managed to get quite a lot of voting power across these platforms, and we've had a really good time participating there.
As a quick follow-up to that, obviously I can see sort of the synergies between like you guys being a delegate for something like Uniswap, Aave, DYDX. What about Arbitrum and Optimism? You know, those are like L2 ecosystems. How are you thinking about your delegate position there? And like, what is your maybe like end goal if there is one?
Yeah, of course. I mean, firstly, like we are investors in some of these projects. So that's something that we do offer, as we really want to help out our portfolio companies on that side and ensure there's like great governance efficiency. So that's the main point why we do it, is ensuring great governance efficiency. But I guess like in terms of like Arbitrum and Optimism, we also really only put our hand up when we know we can like truly add value to certain initiatives. We've had a lot of experience with designing like intensive programs, dealing with grants, dealing with operations. So when things like the Arbitrum, you know, long-term incentive program came up, we put our hand up to join as a council, which we were successful in. Because yeah, these are the areas in which, you know, we think we can actually provide value to the DAO and the community. Yeah.
All right. That's super, super interesting here, and really love how involved you guys are in governance, given that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that can be fixed, and it's great to see you guys take an active role. But thank you so much for coming on, Callan.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Now, moving on to our hot seat coup drone segment, I'm going to throw it over to Boccaccio first for this week's hot seat coup drone.
I am putting MarginFi on the hot seat this week. They, last Thursday, Solblaze, Solana Liquid Staking Protocol, tweeted out that MarginFi stopped distributing Blaze rewards to users, and instead that MarginFi had been selling millions of Blaze per day under the excuse of treasury management. I thought this kind of made sense for Margin. Well, you should obviously be distributing the rewards if that's your like mandate, but it made sense because you don't want to hold that in your treasury. But eventually they ended up solving the situation, and Solblaze stated that like it was all fixed and that emissions would be turned back on. One kind of wonky thing here was that MarginFi claimed that they weren't distributing emissions because of Solana congestion, but then users were like, we haven't been receiving it for months now, or like weeks now. So that was a bit sus. But I think like one of the bigger parts of this was that basically all of CT took the time to like pile onto MarginFi, which I think shows that a lot of people harbor not bad feelings, but kind of like they're kind of upset with the team. And I think this made sense, especially like we've had this twice now. I think Starkware was also a little bit too negative to users, and they were like, oh, you guys are e-beggars. And I feel like MarginFi, they haven't called anybody e-beggars, but they're kind of like on that line of being a little bit rude to users. And so I think quite obvious take is that there's like, these are like mutualistic organisms, like the protocol and the user, and like there's like a agreement. The user pumps the fees and the volume and the transaction counts for the protocol, so the protocol can raise more, and that's like the protocol rewards the user with the airdrop. But I think if you take it this far, think like you start getting like a lot of hate on Twitter, and I think MarginFi is kind of like reaching that point where it's like a bit they're dragging it along a bit much. But I don't know. A lot of other people are saying that this is the biggest fumble of the year. I don't think that's the case. I just think like one of the founders quit. It's like they were talking about a lot of explicit stuff on the timeline. I don't know what's going to end up with them, but I assume they're going to at least like release some more explicit stuff about the token relatively soon.
Yeah, it's interesting. They started their farming program in July of 2023. So we're going on like 9.5 months at this point. They're points farming specifically. So The users, I don't know for sure, but I would guess that that's the longest running points program that we've seen in this industry. So users are kind of fed up. Now, this gets into the debate of like, should, like, is that just being entitled, or, you know, like, give me my token, or, you know, I've been helping your, using your protocol for the last 9 months. I deserve a reward. And it's like, it's hard. I see both sides on this one. Like, at the end of the day, like, just withdraw your capital. Like, you don't have to be there. You're trying to get a free reward from this team that's building a protocol. And for one reason or another, you know, they haven't released the token. I don't envy the position of being a US resident and having the burden of, you know, people wanting me to launch a token. That said, I think Mac like openly said he was rage baiting the community about the token. And like, wow, gee, you pissed off all your people using your product and now they're mad at you. You can't go crying about it like that. So it's hard for me to like really take their side as well. And to be fair, like, he said that's how he acts on Twitter and not in person. And like, that is very much so how you get engagement on Twitter, is like by getting in arguments with people. So there's a bit of playing the game there. And there's also a bit of being a dick. So it's hard to kind of like, I get why the community is pissed, but like, I don't know. Yeah. It just feels like a push and pull there. And to be very clear again, like, I do not envy the position they're in. That's stressful. So I really see both sides on this one.
I thought that there was like no such thing as bad PR, but I think this margin buy was like genuinely bad PR. If I'm not wrong, maybe like 25-30% of the protocols TBL has withdrawn ever since that whole like PR fiasco took place. And I wouldn't be surprised to see like more sustained withdrawals from the protocol. But at some point, like, there is going to be like enough outstanding borrows that like people can't withdraw anymore. And I think that's where it might get like potentially interesting. As far as Mac, I do agree that you do need to be a little bit like contentious or like strongly opinionated to get views on Twitter, but I'm not sure you need to go to the extent of posting a half naked of yourself repeating the word like when token for 2 minutes. I think that's a bit pushing it a little. As far as like the entitlement point, I do think crypto users are pretty entitled, to be honest. Like, if you are using a product, you should be using it because it provides value to, you know, I can understand that like everyone wants free money, like the incentives are structured that way. But for example, like using a Web2 analogy, like Uber in the early days, right? Even accounting for the fact that like Uber gave you like sort of these like ridiculous like $5, $10 like off your Uber rides, you were still using it because Uber provided like a valuable service relative to you standing on the street and like waiting like 5 minutes to flag like a taxi or a cab. And I think the same should apply for crypto, you know, like you should be using something because like it genuinely provides like a valuable service or a product to you. And maybe that's just a state of the industry today, you know, like 99% of these things do not provide a valuable product or service, and they would have no users if they did not sort of like promise any incentives. And I think that's just like half a symptom of like the state of the industry today, and half like the way like just like incentives and sort of like the human desire for free money. I mean, like, you would be kind of like stupid to not want free money, to be honest, as a human.
Yeah, but that's like also fine. You just have to take the mental stance that you're gambling, and you know, you have a cost of capital here.
Exactly. Yeah, well, and I think
money though, that's the thing. Like, you're taking on risk, and also like, quite a lot of, well, not on Solana, there's very limited fees, but you're still losing money. Like, Ren, I'll let you finish and I'll speak, sorry.
No, I was going to say, like, I think Tarun put out a paper 1 year ago about, like, sort of modeling airdrop farming as, like, call options. It's, like, a really, like, quanty, like, nerdy paper. I'm not going to dive into it. And I think that's fair, you know, like, when you are, like, farming, you are explicitly using this protocol for the sake of farming and not just because like you're using it because it provides a valuable right. product or service for you. Like, you should be like, quote unquote, like doing the math. Like, you can't really put numbers to it, but you should be doing the math. It's like, what's your cost of capital, what's the potential like smart contract risk, what's the type of like return you want to be getting. And there's like generally two types of farming, right? One is like the type where you like just like execute transactions through like a DEX, like an AMM. And so like those are cases where you, for example, like farm like ecosystems or like perp DEXs or whatever, like where you don't need to quote unquote lock up capital. You just like run these transactions and you get your collateral back instantly. And there's like the other type of farming, like Parcel or like Camino or Margin Fi, where you have to like lock up your capital for an extended period of time. And there is a definitely like a cost of capital to that, right? And I think like you do need to take into account these dynamics if you are like actively, I'm not going to say like maliciously, but like actively farming these protocols for the sake of like farming. And sure, I definitely agree that it's like a symbiotic relationship at the end of the day. You know, like the protocol gets like a higher engagement, retention, TVL, whatever, choose your metric. And then on the other side, like the user expects something in return, but it's not like there's a legal contract saying like you have to get something back.
It's not a legal contract. The only issue that I have is that I feel like a lot of people read that, not the Tarun one, but the other one, like the cost of the Uniswap airdrop or something. And they were like, oh, like it was actually quite expensive and it's not actually good for protocols to do this. Well, the cost of not doing an airdrop is like, or doing a bad airdrop is like ending up like Paraswap, where you have no users, nothing. And like people can, one of the things is like you can pull out your capital and go to another protocol. But I think like because a crypto has such a like small niche community still, and like they're power users. So if you like piss people off, they will probably avoid using you. And I think like if you're a protocol, yeah, okay, you can tease people and you can be like Mac, where you're like, haha, like am I gonna drop the token, am I not gonna drop the token? But at the end of the day, like there's maybe like 10,000 people on chain, so you really don't want to like take it too far. Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I'm sure they're gonna have to airdrop, and I'm kind of surprised that Mac had to go on Twitter and be like, oh guys, I was always like putting on a face or something. I thought that was obvious, so it was kind of like, and I also don't understand why a lot of people hate, like the product is fine, it's not revolutionary, it's borrowing and lending on the blockchain, but I mean the way that they were acting is like, I feel like there's a very fine line. I think they kind of overstepped it a bit this past month.
Yeah, that's fair. And honestly, my hot seat cool throne kind of parlays into this. And I still don't know if it's a hot seat or a cool throne, but we'll do it in a non-contentious way and put the SEC on the hot seat. So the SEC has put out a Wells notice to Uniswap Labs regarding the creation of their protocol. And so a quick one too on the Wells notice. So a Wells notice from the SEC is a formal communication notifying the recipient that the SEC staff intends to recommend enforcement action against them. So basically it's a letter that says, hey, we're coming, and here's why. But basically it's an opportunity for the recipient to respond to the allegations and kind of get your case ready and make it to the SEC before they bring that enforcement action to you. And these generally end up in following into like a court hearing. So they basically turn into a lawsuit, as the recipient will likely sue the SEC back. Hayden put out a tweet on this, Hayden Adams, DC, founder of Uniswap, and said, I'm confident that the products we offer are legal and that our work is on the right side of history, but it's been clear for a while that rather than working to create a clear informed rule set, the SEC has decided to focus on attacking longtime good actors like Uniswap and Coinbase, all while letting bad actors like FTX slip by. The industry rallied around them when this news came out, and rightfully so. There's plenty of bad actors in this industry, so it's a little bit frustrating to see. There's plenty of very malicious actors, when I say bad actors, right? Like people that are genuinely just straight up scamming you. And so, you know, people that have been around and have been built a very useful product for a lot of people, it's kind of upsetting to see. So there's a couple questions here around what exactly the SEC is going to go after, you know, whether or not the web app or the wallet that they have are brokers in terms of like being the interface that users buy and sell securities through, whether or not the Uni token itself is a security, and whether or not, again, the protocols, so like the actual AMM contracts, are unregistered security exchanges. There's a couple different angles here. Don't really know how this is all going to play out. I am very much so not a lawyer and have no desire to be, so I will have no indication on whether or not these are going, which direction these will lean. But the Uni token as a security one is kind of interesting because there was an airdrop to users. So there was like no investment of money on behalf of the users. But there were, they, Uniswap Labs did raise for the protocol using a token sale to investors. So there is still this like push and pull here between Uniswap Labs, like the private centralized company, and Uniswap Protocol, again, really just the DAO that controls and owns the AMM contracts themselves. So it's interesting to see this push and pull because Uniswap Labs there's been a long push, token holders are very upset because they're not getting a portion of protocol revenue. We'll definitely get into that. And Labs is like, you know, again, this like this centralized entity that's like a business, a company in the traditional world. And they have a team and they built a product and they built, you know, ancillary products around the protocol. And they have to continue funding themselves. But there's the token holders feel like they're playing second fiddle to the equity holders, right? So Labs will create a new product instead of like giving this and doing this on behalf of the DAO, they're doing it on behalf of themselves. And that revenue is, you know, retained within the decentralized entity. So recently there was another development for this. I discovered this on Saturday, the 13th. Uniswap Labs has a fee for anything that goes through the UIs that they've created, whether that be the web app, I think it's like app.uniswap.org, I want to say. Don't quote me on that. Just the traditional Uniswap web app, or whether it be like through the wallet that they have. Formerly, that was a 0.15% fee from the like tokens you would receive. And that was only on a subset of swaps. So it was on like basically the largest pair was like ETH, swapping between like a stablecoin and ETH. But it wouldn't be anything like related to like a meme coin. It was a very small subset of assets. And they also excluded unwrapping and wrapping WEETH and stablecoin to stablecoin swaps. So they were just trying to take a cut of fees and generate a new source of revenue. They were annualized at about 20 million or so over the last couple of months of this fee existing. But after the announcement from Hayden, it was a couple of hours later, they quietly raised the fee from 0.15% to 0.25%, and they actually included all swaps as eligible, with the only exception still remaining to be stablecoin to stablecoin swaps and wrapping and unwrapping wrapped ether. So it was a little interesting they didn't announce this. I think that's kind of two reasons for that. Is one, I don't know if you want to go screaming this from the hilltops after you just received a wellness notice that you're taking a fee from your front ends. I don't know. Like, it was still going to become news. So it does feel weird they didn't announce it. And this rubbed people the wrong way. While the first wave of when they received the wellness notice, everyone kind of unanimously was, hey, we got Uniswaps back. Then this fee hike gets brought back up, which reminds everybody that there's a front end fee and that does not go to the DAO, and the sentiment very quickly changed. And it feels like everyone is now again like hating on Uniswap Labs. When they first announced this fee, maybe 6 or so months ago, it was chaos. Like, people were so upset. And this kind of gets back to the entitlement or like what do token holders deserve question of, you know, you raised four labs using the token and sold the token, yet the token is not getting any cut of revenue generated by these ancillary products from that Uniswap Labs creates. And this is like a very interesting discussion because there's also the protocol level fee switch, which would take a portion of the fees that go to LPs today and give that to the DAO. And that has been long, long debated. It's been made the most progress it's ever made in the last couple of months. I believe the foundation recently posted in the forums that they kind of wanted to push this forward. This was all pre-Wells notice. And I believe that contracts are going through audits right now. So timeline was like, you know, a couple months max for this to start to sort of hit the forums to really start moving. I don't know what's going to happen now. Like, would be kind of crazy if you were to push the fee switch through while you're in a lawsuit with the SEC in some regard. But it's also a power move of like Uni Labs is the one being sued here, or the one under investigation here. And, you know, no one from Uni Labs is pushing this fee switch through. It's like, this is a decentralized protocol. And it is, you know, the distinction here is quite important, where there's the labs entity, the one that has created and launched the protocol, the one that is being investigated by the SEC. And then there's the on-chain contracts controlled by the DAO and the token holders. And that would be the one that would push the protocol level fee switch through. So I know I said a lot there, so I'll pause, but it's a pretty interesting development.
I think Dan might get caught as a witness during the SEC court hearing, just given how comprehensive that was, to be honest. But on a more serious note, I think this fee hike is like the biggest FU that Uniswap could do to the SEC after they announced, like, after they sent the Wells notice. I mean, like, without rehashing the entire debate too much, there's always going to be fundamentally like a clashing force between labs and the token. It is very much so like a zero-sum game. However, I do think with the advent of like Uniswap V4 and other existing or like sort of like up and coming LVR mitigation solutions that will probably deliver a lot more like yield slash returns to LPs, that debate becomes a lot less of a concern, just because like if you solve LVR and you manage to like capture a lot of the LVR value that's being captured by searches today, and that is the bulk of like sort of like the IL slash LVR loss that's seen by LPs today, then you're gonna like basically there's gonna be a lot more money flowing around, and people are gonna be a lot less like stingy and thinking zero sum and think like a bit more positive sum. You know, like my LP returns just went from 5% to 15%. I'm totally chill with giving out like 15% of the LP fees to Uni token holders. Now, having said that, if I bought the Uni token before like the protocol fee switch like announcement by Uniswap Foundation like 1 month ago, I don't think I would ever have had the expectation of there being a fee switch like ever, to be honest. There's probably like a lot of traders out there who like put on a position thinking of like a protocol fee switch, but I would have like express that position just solely in the hopes that like Uniswap continues to maintain or even like increase its DEX market share like dominance in terms of volume, and over time like increase its market share or like expand into new verticals such as like Uniswap X or like sort of like cross-chain bridging. But yeah, it's an interesting position, and I think you will probably see that tension appear in many more DeFi protocols, to be honest, just because there's a lot of sort of like these like clashing dynamics between like the equity side of things and the token side of things. However, I'm not familiar with VC and like when like SAFs became a common thing where like the equity is converted into the token, and so there's not so much of like a equity token like divide. Maybe that divide is a lot bigger for Uniswap, where there's like a lot of investors in the equity side of things and there's like a lot of investors in the token side of things. But I would guess, if I had to guess, like in sort of like the more recent years, that dynamic has shifted like a lot more to the token side of things rather than investors like still holding equity and like even thinking about that, to be honest. And so that dynamic probably is like less of a problem going forward.
Yeah, and I would hope for that problem to be less of a problem going forward. It's definitely not ideal. So it's the protocol level fee switch is an interesting one. I'm glad you mentioned V4 though, Ren, and like what that could potentially do. Because, you know, maybe in a world where there's actually let's back up. Uniswap, the protocol, is a marketplace that matches traders with liquidity, and the trader pays a fee for the execution. And so Uniswap, the protocol, has the ability to take a portion of that fee and, you know, retain that as their top line revenue. So let's say there was like, you know, $1,000 trade that went through. The trader paid a $1 fee to the liquidity provider. Uniswap could take, you know, 10 cents of that $1 fee. And like that would be the revenue. And as the DAO doesn't really have a large amount of costs today, you know, you could basically pass that back, that 10 cents back to the token holders. To me, that doesn't make any sense. Your product is really good. People use it. People love it. And on an LVR basis, as Ren mentioned, like your LPs are getting smoked on average. There's sharp LPs that are like very actively trading or moving around their LP positions to stay profitable. But on the whole, you know, it is not profitable to deposit into an AMM and leave it there. And so now you want to, LPs are essential to make the whole protocol run. If LPing was like egregiously unprofitable, there's probably a breakpoint where, you know, the LPs leave, liquidity weakens and goes elsewhere, and less people trade. There is probably a breakpoint there. Or if you wanted to just like increase the total fee, and then the DAO takes a cut of the higher total fee, where LPs still end up making the same amount of money, but traders pay more, your volume will decrease. Gauntlet's done some pretty interesting work on like what that trade-off would look like. And there probably is a happy medium here, but like just zooming out a bit, you're basically saying, let's make our product worse for LPs who are essential to making this protocol run, or our product work for traders by charging more, just to like return revenue to the token holder. Like to me, that does not add up there. And the ideal result would say we need to build more products to make that actually generate profits, right? Like even the notion of returning revenue to token holders doesn't make sense. You would return profits to token holders, right? After all of these costs have been subtracted. So I don't know. I think there's just a mismatch in like the reality. And let's say you did turn this fee switch on, like you're looking at like 1.5% yield. Like that's not like, guys, like half the people demanding it don't get out of bed for anything less than triple digit yield when they go farm these things, right? So it just doesn't, it seems like it just became this huge narrative that most people just are not thinking through. But like, and to put a bow on this, I think you can really hate the practices of, you know, prioritizing the equity holder and not the token holder, and think that Uniswap Labs is terrible people, and think that they've had some shady malpractice or are pretentious people. That's all fine. You can think that and be like, yeah, but at the end of the day, the protocol is still pretty immature. Doesn't generate a dollar of revenue today. And turning the fee switch on kind of like negatively impacts the quality of our product. Like you can think both of those things. And I don't know, people kind of, you have like turn them into camps, and I don't know, it's strange.
I agree with you on the LP, like adding a fee on the LP side of it, and then to distribute to token holders, I don't think that makes any sense. I think if you were going to do it, you should have done the front end, but that's owned by Uniswap Labs, not the protocol, so you can't.
Which does get into this really weird thing of like, if you're going to be a Labs team and you're going to raise using the token, what do you have to give to the DAO, like to control? Because I agree, like there's very clearly a weird push and pull. But we've like, they're not the only people that do this. If you look at Solana, for example, Jito is very beloved, and Jito Labs owns the block engine, and they take a 5% fee of every tip that runs through, and nobody seems to have a problem with that.
The one thing I will say about, not about Jito, about Uniswap is, you know, you were like, why do people care? I feel like people care about like Uniswap specifically because I think Uniswap's kind of like the decision that Uniswap has will likely affect the rest. Do you know what I mean? Like it'll just create this new like paradigm of returning 1.5% to token holders. No, but that's like, I think a lot of protocols are, first, I don't know if you're a protocol. This is one thing I understand, like when McBrennan was tweeting about it on the MarketFi side, I was like, okay, that's fair. That they were like, we're an American-based team, that's why we're not dropping a token. That makes sense. But I feel like a lot of those teams, first of all, I don't know why you're in America if you're, do you know what I mean? The great United States, great country, but also like it's very difficult to drop a token there because of the whole regulatory stuff. But I got distracted talking about the US again. Basically, what I wanted to say was
ripping the gator.
Ripping the gator, Sony Pop. Basically, what I wanted to say was, I think a lot of these teams are waiting for Uniswap to kind of make a decision, and like for there to be a decision made about Uniswap to drop tokens. So I think that's why everyone's kind of interested in that, not because of the 1.5% yield.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree with that. And like that was the original sentiment around the Wells notice, was like, you guys are fighting the good fight. You know, where if you're like really trying to win this, you kind of want them to go after the Uniswap in some way. Like, they're well funded.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they're kind of our DeFi's best shot at winning this. And some people may disagree with that. But and just to be clear, I wasn't trying to like throw Jito under the bus here at all either. I love what they're doing. I love that team. It's just an interesting comparison where Labs is taking a cut of something the protocol is doing. And in my mind, like, these protocols are like very much VC stage, venture stage bets. And you got to fund the people building the thing. And yes, there's a token. And like, we still don't really know what the incentive trade-off there is, but I don't know. I don't think it's crazy that the Labs team is making money. Like, I just don't think that's crazy.
I think that's something not a lot of people think about, is that Uniswap is still like a venture stage team, because in crypto, it feels like every month is a year. They're like, oh, like, Uniswap's already an established protocol. Like, it's there now. It's like Costco, et cetera, but it's not, it's just like, it's new.
Realistically, I think where crypto is today, like, everything is still in like the growth venture stage. Like, nothing, not even like Ethereum, dude, has reached like the proper like stable like long term stage. A few random points in terms of like the yield on like a uni token fee switch. Sure, like, it's not ridiculous, and that is definitely a symptom of crypto having these like completely ridiculous yield expectations from the user side. But if you look at it, like, the S&P has an average dividend yield of 1.35%, and at current prices, the uni token yield would probably be, I don't know, maybe like 2-3%, maybe a bit lower than that. And so it doesn't look too crazy from like a mature company. Like, should a company be returning like paying out a dividend yield at this stage? Like, definitely
no.
Yeah, I know that.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Reinvest in growth. You're in one of the most high growth industries at the far edge of the risk spectrum. Returning profits at this point makes literally no sense. I cannot wrap my head around it. Reinvesting growth every time. And maybe that's part of the problem here is, you know, Labs is taking a cut of this, is creating this front end revenue stream, and we have no idea where it's going. You know, today maybe it's a little bit more obvious. It's probably going to lawyer fees, but prior to that, it was a little less clear. But yet they created this wallet, which again plugs directly into the Uniswap protocol, and they're building ancillary products around it that drives more volume to the protocol, making it, you know, increasing the utility of the protocol. So that to me, that is reinvesting in growth. So I don't know. But again, I also see the other side where the incentives are pretty misaligned.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to move on to my hot seat, Kutons. I'll try to keep it short. I have Tensor in the hot seat this week. So Tensor did their airdrop, I want to say last Monday. They airdropped 12.5% of their token supply. At its peak, the token reached roughly like 2 billion FTV. Is now trading pretty down at 913 million. As a point of comparison, Blur is currently trading at a 1.2 billion FTV. So it's not that different, to be honest. I think still a relatively okay airdrop for most people. However, I do think that there were some wallets, mostly whales, that were relatively unhappy with the amount they got. And as a result, Tensor announced a few days ago that they will be distributing an additional 2.3% of the supply to top up the top 2,900 wallets to make their distribution entirely linear. I'm not sure if that was the right move, to be honest. That seems like a wild move to do, like, post-TGE, even if, like, your whales are really pissy about, like, not getting it. And I think that shows in the numbers, right? Like, even with that airdrop allocation, Magic Eden has gone from, like, a really, really small percentage of Solana volume to, like, dominating Solana volume at, like, 90%+ if you look at, like, 24-hour trading volume. And similarly, on another front, like, Tensorians, the NFT collection of Tensor has gone from a peak of 138 SOL to the current 18 SOL. Like, so obviously, there were a lot of expectations of people buying it for it solely for the airdrop, then nothing more. I don't know. I feel like, I don't think Tensor, like, did this airdrop perfectly. I feel like there was a lot more they could have done. For example, like, perpetual incentive programs, giving out, like, less of the supply so that they save more as, like, future incentives. Because, like, it's not hard to see that like Magic Eden has something else on the roadmap, you know, and that you will be competing with them post your TGE. And like nothing ever exists in like a siloed environment. You're always going to have competitors in crypto, especially given like how many copycats there are and how fast it is to go to market a lot of the time. And yeah, I just feel like there's a lot left to be desired, to be honest, from this airdrop. I mean, it was a good airdrop, don't get me wrong. Like I think a lot of people did really well in terms of like just the amount of money they got, but from a sort of like a business like strategy point of view, I feel like they probably could have done better.
I feel like a lot of people who weren't expecting to get airdropped got airdropped on this one. Like I think a lot of people were expecting directly like linear, like entirely linear, and then not like the ones that, I don't know what they're called, the ones that reward Sybils where you just do like one NFT transaction and you get like 800 tensor or something. But this one, like, I think actually rewarded them. So it was interesting. I don't have like a big take on how they did the airdrop. I think it is, I agree with you, Ren. I think it's a bit weird to distribute like more after you do it. But I mean, you never want to make the people who have the most money angry, or at least like that, like angry enough to.
Yeah, but yeah, like you say that, but I think like these people still left regardless, even with the additional 2.2%. So like it's obviously like really hard to know. It's not like you're a founder, you can go ask like your will, like, hey, like if I give you like an additional 2.3% and make your urge of linear, will you not go and farm Magic Eden, please? Like it doesn't really work like that. So you just have to use your best judgment of the competitive landscape. But yeah.
You know, one thing is I was talking to a friend and they were like, oh, I actually prefer Magic Eden to Tensor. And I was like, do you prefer OpenSea to Blur? And they prefer OpenSea to Blur. And to me, it seems like so crazy, but because I feel like Blur is the superior product there. Obviously, like Magic Eden is dominating volume because of the airdrop. But I'm just saying, like, there are actually people who are like, oh, I'd rather use Magic Eden over Blur, over Tensor.
I've pulled up this dashboard from Marku. He's a beast. We'll put a link to his Twitter in the description here. But for the listeners, this chart in the top right here is, or for the viewers, there's a chart in the top right. And for the listeners, it's a chart on organic trade count. So just looking at the number of trades by marketplace on Solana. So this specific dashboard filters out wash trading versus organic trading. There's a couple cool filters that they've created to do so. But you'll actually see this huge sharp drop off in Tensor, this Tensor Swap, this greenish yellowish color post airdrop, right? You've seen a huge material decrease in the number of trades. Even these are organic trades, so this is getting past the wash trading filter. So take that as you will, but it's interesting to see the huge drop off. And the question is, okay, well, where are those users going? And later on this dashboard, we can see the wash trade count. So basically the other side of the organic trade. And you can see there was never really a ton of, previously there was like in February, there was a lot of wash trading being picked up on TensorSwap. But these filters didn't catch a ton going into the airdrop. But you will see a pretty steep increase in the number of wash trades occurring on Magic Eden. Which like Magic Eden, I think had 98% of total NFT volume on Solana quickly. I think that was today actually. And so it's just kind of interesting to see how that has quickly shifted where, you know, we just talked about farmers with MarginFi. And if you airdrop to farmers and they just go somewhere else and sell your token, like that is not an effective distribution of your token. Sure, you made them rich and maybe they'll come back later, but like if they literally just pick up and leave and go somewhere else and sell your token, like that's kind of a miss. You know, you want to incentivize people to use your product. They use it and then they're like, oh shit, this is like a really great product for X, Y, and Z that I do. And then continue to use it. Like that's really the goal. So I don't know. I don't have too many thoughts on the specifics of these stats and as it pertains to the quality of the Tensor airdrop, but it is kind of interesting to see that, you know, with Magic Eden running its Diamonds Points program, it's already picked up some of the active trading activity.
By the way, the Magic Eden team has done a great job with the ordinal stuff. Like, there's nowhere else. This is not related to Tensor at all, but I just wanted to bring that up in case they're listening. You guys did I'm very happy with that, what they're doing. And I wish Blur had done that instead of launch an L2. Like, I wish they had gone into ordinals.
No, I agree. I feel like 6 months ago, everyone was calling maybe a little more than 6 months ago, everyone was like, oh my god, it's like the craziest thing, like Ken just run up from like nothing into like dominating like 80-90% of Solana NFT volume. And now you're seeing like obviously there's incentives involved, but Magic Eden like completely dominating ordinals. And I think they would dominate even without sort of like any incentive program. But yeah, now they're also like dominating the Solana side of things. So I think just like looking at like the ordinal side of things, like not considering the Solana side of things, I think like at the end of the day, that was a fantastic pivot from Magic Eden and like a really, really good move. And it's interesting, you know, like they launch on like Solana and Ethereum as their like home basis early on. And I think that just shows like how nimble you have to be on your feet in crypto, right? And sometimes like the opportunity may not be where you think it lies.
Yeah, I think ordinals is like a natural place for like OpenSea Classic and Magic Eden, because it's like Bitcoin slow. So you can't really trade stuff that like, because Blur, even now, like Blur, you can't really trade that much because gas fees are so high. And like, but like Solana and Tensor just make perfect sense because you're like actively trading a lot. But on like the ordinals, beat Bitcoin, you don't really have to. So I feel like Magic Eden suits it really well. It's, you just need like something trusted and that works. And they provide that.
Yeah, strong agree there. All right, I got one last super quick Goose Drone. Eigen Layer and Eigen DA mainnet launch. It happened on April 9th. I feel like a lot of people have been waiting for that one for quite some time, to be honest. With this launch, VStakers can dedicate their entire stake to an operator of choice. Operators can register with Eigen Layer and opt into running AVSs. AVSs can register with the protocol, starting with Eigen DA, which is sort of like the first AVS. There are two things at this launch doesn't include, which I do think is like kind of important. Number one, in protocol payments from AVSs to operators, and number two, slashing. And I do think there's an interesting question to be asked here. Like, you know, if there's no slashing and there's no in protocol payments, like what is being transferred? You know, like risk is being not being transferred, like economic security is not being transferred. There's no payment for the economic security. So is it just like a database of like, this person has on paper like $500 million in ETH in like sort of like restaked commitments, whatever that means. I do think it kind of looks like that, at least to me right now. I do feel like it's a bit of like a silly season, especially with alternate restaking platforms that have launched. For example, Karak was like a pretty big thing last week where everyone was sharing around invite codes. And Karak is basically Eigen Layers, but with a bunch of like other assets. And with Karak, you can restake these LRTs that are restaked in Eigen Layer. And, you know, at some point,
very, very good there.
At some point, it starts looking a little silly. You know, like I take ETH, I stake it for like an LST, I restake it for like an LRT, I put my LRT in like Pendo, and then like I buy like the yield token on Pendo, and I take the yield token and then like put that in Karak. Like, I'm not really sure what we're doing now, to be honest.
We're having fun. It's nice. You know, we're taking some risks. It'll be good. It'll all end up very well and very good. No, nothing bad could happen from this one.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, we got to get the apps that all of this shit secures figured out. The ever growing problem. But yeah, Ryan, I mean, you bring up a good point with the launch. I mean, a lot of things launch, like you got to get it out there, launch it with the training wheels, and then, you know, let's grow. The question is, how long does it take to take those training rules off? You know, if we look at L2s, launched optimistic rollups with no fraud proofs. Many of them still have no fraud proofs, though they're on, you know, like the OP stack has them on testnet and they're permissionless, which is still an upgrade on something like Arbitrum, which has permissioned fraud proofs. But yeah, like they all still have multi-sigs. They're all still going to have multi-sigs well into the future. The question becomes, how long can we survive with the training wheels on? And I personally have no ETA on what that expectation should be. But that's definitely something, that's a question I'm looking to ask when I think about Eigen Layer.
I do think, like, yes, like maybe the security of L2s or like rollups is like questionable given the fact that like they don't have fraud proof, but it still provides the value that like it was meant to do, you know, like scaling sort of like Ethereum execution by moving it off chain and having like a slightly more performant like blockchain. Whereas for Eigenlayer, like you are the value and like service it provides, right, is that you're providing like this recent capital and you're sharing your security with an AVS in expectation for some economic return. And the fact
I would disagree though. I think the value you're providing is a cheaper way to go to market to launch my product. Like if I'm an AVS, like for example, a lot of the AVSs are building using the Cosmos SDK and they could just launch an app chain, spin up a validator set and create the same thing. But this should be a better way to do that. And so, yeah, sure, I can't pay you. That's good for the user. And sure, you're not really giving me economic security because there's no slashing. It's basically just like this reputation-based system that, hey, you're going to run the thing I need you to run in your own hardware. Kind of gets me to market. And I have way worse trust assumptions now because I'm doing this. But that's the same thing as like an L2, right? The blast hack that happened not too long ago, everyone was talking about rolling back the chain. It was an interesting example because, sure, you could potentially roll back the chain, and but if you nobody's ever done that before, so you're the first person doing it, paving the way for other people to follow in your footsteps if this were to happen again. And what that means is if you upgrade the bridge contract and end up bricking it, then you just locked and just burned all the $1 billion of value in that contract. So nobody wants to be the person to do that. So I don't know, like, my point there being like there's just different trust assumptions with L2s that get introduced, and like it kind of feels like the same thing with these AVSs, right? No slashing, no in protocol payments. You're just kind of saying, hey, go run this thing for me. How dissimilar is that really than a single centralized sequencer, no fraud proofs, and a multi-sig bridge?
That's fair. I think that's a very fair take. And like, full disclosure, if I was Eigenlayer and I knew it would take me like 6 months more to like fully developed in protocol payments and slashing, like I would have made the entirely same move, to be honest. Just a faster go to market.
Right.
You don't want to like wait until like the entire cycle is over to launch these two products. And by then, you know, like maybe alternative solutions have captured the entire mindshare. And I'm sure like other restaking solutions are also just trying to ship as fast as they can, even if it comes at the cost of like some of these like functionality. Whether that's slashing. And yeah, I guess so. You could argue that at the end of the day, like the thing that's the most important is that like capital commitment, however you want to like think of that, and that is like the true enabler of like all of these AVSs and decreasing the cost of like permissionless innovation.
Yeah. Dan, do you want to talk about your Eigenlayer token thesis or no?
I mean, I don't know if it's a thesis. I just don't. If your end goal is to be ingrained or enshrined into the Ethereum protocol, I don't see how you can do that with a token. Or maybe not don't see. The hurdle to doing so is much higher with a token, right? If there's an Eigenlayer itself token,
yeah,
how do you get enshrined? And my understanding is that's kind of like the end goal, long-term end goal. You know, we actually had Sriram and Subit, I think it was, on the podcast. Ren and I interviewed them, and we asked the question, this is all fine and dandy. You guys are building really cool shit. But how are you going to make money? You know, you raise capital, the labs team is a business, you got to make money. And their answer was, we're going to build the best AVSs. You know, we've been around this technology for longer than anyone. And I'm paraphrasing here, but we've been around this technology. We know some really, really good ideas, and we're going to send our guys to go build them. Like, that was kind of their pitch was, we're not going to make money on Eigenlayer. We're going to make money on the AVSs around it. That said, like, a token could be very useful here, right? Eigenlayer will have really important governance processes around like how the slashing parameters are created and what those look like, how they change throughout time. You know, I mentioned the training wheels earlier. How do we take those off? When do we take those off? Like a governance token would actually serve a purpose here. So I do see why there can be one, but I just think it sort of conflates with the end goal of being enshrined. Maybe that's not the end goal. Maybe like sitting on top of Ethereum is perfectly fine. I don't know. I just think if end goal enshrined in Ethereum, then token doesn't make sense. But like there's a points program. You know, this team also just saw what happened with MarginFi. That'd be disastrous for Ethereum if, you know, all of these depositors are now furious with Eigenlayer. I don't think that would go over very well.
No, I also don't think so, especially since it's like, because Solana's now had a couple of liquidity injections, and I feel like Ethereum people are expecting one as well. But one thing about the enshrinement thing is that I like, this is an old, this is going to be my first attempt at presenting something, but I want to try it out. But basically, on the, can you see it?
Yep.
Okay. So basically, this is like on the ETH research forum, and it's very clearly that like Shriram, both Shriram and Vitalik are like, we don't think that it makes sense to enshrine. So I'm not sure, because I've been hearing quite a bit that they're going to enshrine, and I'm just kind of unclear.
I thought that was a goal, and I'm very happy to be wrong about that. I'm not, that's not a hill I'm trying to die on. So that's good to know. But, and the other reason I think it, that is new to when we originally talked about this was, you know, Karak is launching, and there's another one launching shortly after that. I'm blanking on the name. I'm sure more of these will come to be. You'll probably see like some launch on other chains as well. And so let's say there's multiple that launch around Ethereum. Okay, now you're not being incredibly neutral because you're picking one. And like Ethereum very much so has built itself around being incredibly neutral and not picking winners. So that kind of like, when we originally talked about this, I didn't think there'd actually be multiple restaking protocols.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do.
It also kind of does feel like something there should maybe only be one of. I know we talk about like, we all love competition. Free markets are elite. But if we all try all these paths, you know, sometimes coalescing around a few ideas might be more efficient. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like Eigenlayer should be its own thing. And like, it should just be that.
Well, Boccaccio just defined a market for us. Thank you, Boccaccio. Can you tell me what of my bags is going to be its own thing?
Oh, I meant like it should be its own thing. Not
I know,
it
I know. Be its own thing. I'm messing with you, but I think that's a good point to close it off. Thank you so much, Dan, for coming back on ZeroX. Hope you come back more often, and good job, Boccaccio, on your first episode.
The new host, baby.
Let's go.